Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, where we're hearing two oral arguments this morning on Zoom.gov. Thank you for working with us through this new technology. It's March 4th. Marshall, will you call the first case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Werke, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The case before the court is A20-1101. Nathan Mead versus BNSF Railway Co.
Thank you. Counsel, the same basic rules apply here as they do in our physical courtroom. So each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note there is a timer on the screen, so we will keep track, so that will help us all keep track of the time as it passes by. Please introduce yourself at the beginning of your arguments and who you represent, because we do record these and make our oral arguments available on our website. And finally, something that we aren't usually worried about in our physical courtroom, if you have technical difficulties of any sort, and those are becoming rare during these oral arguments, but if you do, let us know, or send Pam an email or a note, and we'll stop, make sure things get on track so that everyone has a full opportunity to present their case to us. And with that, counsel for appellant, I turn to you.
Good morning. My name is William Cabas. I'm the attorney representing Nathan Mead, the plaintiff in the court below and the appellant in this court. The question before this court today is not whether Mr. Muzzy is right or Ms. Yake is right. Instead, the question before the court is, did Mr. Muzzy do enough to provide the foundation for the opinions he identified in his report and meet the requirements of Rule 702?
Well, Mr. Cavaz, can I stop you there? Because I'm not sure if I agree with that assessment. Our standard of review is of what the district court decided and whether the district court abused its discretion, correct?
That's correct.
Because the way you're phrasing it, it almost makes it sound like we're doing a de novo review as to whether or not his opinion satisfied the foundational requirements. And that's not our role.
Right. But in terms of looking at whether or not Judge Klein abused his discretion, it's important to analyze the evidence that was presented under the rubric of Rule 702.
Right, but we do that in light of whether or not that there is evidence in the record to support the district court's decision. And if there is, even if we disagree with the decision, and even if we would have come to a different decision, I should say, case law makes very clear, even if we would have come up with a different decision, as long as the record supports the district court's decision, we must affirm.
And that's really the issue here. Because one, there's no question, and BNSF has never questioned the qualifications of Dr. Muzzy, who's an engineer with 59 years experience in the field and conducted numerous, over 2,000 tests of human individuals, and holds a patent for seat restraint systems. The court, in its order of June 18th, 2018, which excluded Mr. Muzzy's opinion, included the following opinion by the court. Because Mr. Muzzy did not conduct any inspection of Unit 20 or its seat latch mechanism, Mr. Muzzy's opinion that the failure of the driver's seat back mechanism in Unit 20 was due to ineffective and defective maintenance is speculation.
Correct. And you're citing the district court's opinion on page 8, but you're omitting the prior analysis by the district court, which talks about other factors. The district court is not just relying on that one factor in making its decision.
But that was a factor he identified as indicating that the opinion was speculative. And in that regard, we need to look at the evidence that was marshaled that Mr. Muzzy had. He had multiple photographs of Unit 20. He had the video from the accident. He had the maintenance records of Bona Brothers for the service on the vehicle. He had the BNSF company vehicle policy and procedures manual. He had depositions of the transcripts of the plaintiff, multiple BNSF employees, Bona Brothers employees, BNSF discovery responses, drawings of the driver's seat for the Ford Ranger, and the report of David Hallman, who calculated the delta V-kelp forces in this accident. Now, based on that, then Mr. Muzzy proceeds to explain that before Mr. Mead was assigned to take the vehicle, and this is in Mr. Mead's deposition, he did an inspection, as was required by BNSF, of the vehicle. He noted safety concerns about the vehicle. He didn't want to take it. He was overruled and he was ordered to take it. Mr. Mead testified that during the collision, the seat back failed and he torpedoed through the back window, crashing through that window and into a rack mounted in the bed of the truck. The truck that he had been assigned to use was a truck that was used 24 hours a day, three shifts per day.
Mr. Koska, if I may, we're pretty familiar with the record, but there are a couple of questions I just wanted to ask as far as the factual foundation. And the first is where he had the factual foundation to opine that Bona Brothers knew or should have known that the mechanism needed maintenance. I mean, Mr. Lawler says he had problems with this, but he didn't tell Bona Brothers. Where do we have factual basis for that notice? Because don't we need it?
Factual basis for the notice to BNSF comes from Mr. Lawler. And also, Bona Brothers records reflect in 2011 that the seat was worn out to the point where metal was exposed. And the note for that repair reflected replace driver seat assembly.
Can I stop you there? Because you're citing to two different things. I'd like to break it down to follow up on Judge Justin's questions. You mentioned notice from Mr. Lawler. What specific notice did he provide?
The notice that he had had a failure where the seat reclined without him moving the lever.
Are you talking about the one that the unsworn testimony that he provided that he later contradicted?
The testimony or the statement that he provided indicated he had experienced a failure with the seat mechanism before.
But are you talking about the unsworn testimony that he gave that he later contradicted?
That was the contemporaneous statement, yes, that he gave following the incident.
Because the district court specifically highlighted that actually in I believe it was page 7 of its order, that Mr. Lawler initially, that the expert, Mr. Muzzy, relied on that initial statement, but then that statement had later been contradicted by his sworn deposition testimony stating, I guess I was wrong there.
All right, let's go back then with respect to the issue of notice. When Bona Brothers received the vehicle, the note they had was to replace the seat assembly because it had been worn to the point literally metal was exposed on the seat. The directions were to replace the seat assembly. That was not done by Bona Brothers, who was an agent as noted in Mead 1.
Are you talking about replacing the seat cushion, which is different from the mechanism that's in dispute here?
But the note says replace driver seat assembly. And that was not done. Instead, the seat was reupholstered without replacement of the latch mechanism, which controls the forward and aft direction of the seat, and the frame assembly, which includes the controls for the back seat recliner, was not replaced.
As far as this, the entire seat argument, Muzzy's testimony, it's determined whether he had foundational reliability, which is where we're at. Why didn't he have to consider the opposing evidence? I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Why did he not have to consider opposing evidence in shaping his opinion? I mean, to me, if you're going to be an expert, you need to consider all of the facts
he considered the facts and then made a determination based on his experience as 59 years of a mechanical engineer.
In his report, did he talk about the review of the seat after the fact that it was operating correctly?
That was Bona Brothers BNS agents' determination that they
That's what I'm getting at. In terms of reliability, if you want to have foundational pass muster as far as whether it's going to aid or help the jury, don't you have to show that the expert that you're proposing has considered all of these facts?
He needs to consider them, but in his opinion, he has described what he believed happened, because there is a competing version of facts, an alternative, and an expert that's been tendered by BNSF means you have a battle between experts, and the question of whether there is contradictory evidence goes to the weight and not the admissibility of the testimony.
I have a question, another question along those lines. First of all, I share the concern about the lack of work done to actually counter the examination, the actual physical examination that had been done by Bona Brothers. As the district court noted, he never did that, correct?
I don't see in his report that there's any identification of specifically considering the alternate theories and then ruling them out. Rather, he is looking at the evidence as it exists and drawing conclusions based on that evidence.
Right, but my point is the Bona Brothers actually physically inspected the car, including the seat mechanism, but Mr. Muzzy never did that.
He did not do that, and in fact, Jennifer Yake, the expert tendered by BNSF, felt it was not necessary to do that.
Well, but they had already had a positive examination. But I want to ask another question, and this goes to Mr. Muzzy's report. At one point, he says that, quote, it would have been prudent to rebuild the entire seat structure or replace it with a new seat. And he doesn't say that they should have. He just says it would have been prudent, which seems to be very, very squishy language, quite frankly, for an expert report. But when he says it would have been prudent to rebuild the seat structure, he also talks about challenges the way the seat structure had been built in the first place, and seems to challenge and say that it was built wrong in the very first instance. That seems to be a challenge to the manufacturer.
No, I don't believe there's any suggestion in his report that there's any manufacturing defect. In fact, as he points out in his report, the concept of the rigid seat that would be designed to prevent this type of accident with a delta V force under 35 miles an hour is something that was standardized and discussed at length as early as 1969. Mr. Muzzy does not state anywhere in his report that he is blaming the design. Rather, what he is blaming is the fact that there was to be a replacement of the seat assembly, and in fact, the mechanical mechanisms that contain the restraint mechanism were not replaced. And in terms of his using the word prudent for them to do it, that is what ordinary care requires. What does an ordinarily prudent person do? And that was the language that Mr. Muzzy used in the report.
You argue that the denial of Muzzy as an expert in this case goes to the weight of the testimony, and I appreciate that. But besides, and in addition to the fact that he didn't examine, that isn't the only thing, that he did not examine, was it car 20, as far as the seat mechanism, and there was other conflicting evidence that he also failed to examine. And, you know, district court judges are gatekeepers. You want something to be understandable to a jury. He didn't consider the normal wear and tear. And then we had Lawler's testimony. I mean, isn't it incumbent on someone who is going to be labeled as an expert, and then you have the deference that's given to an expert to analyze other possibilities, not just come forward and say, this is my theory, I'm not going to look at anything else?
Well, quite frankly, to render the opinions he rendered, he had the evidence to do it. You had a vehicle that had $80,000 worth of repairs, a vehicle that in its first year.
Well, you're saying he did, but was this a part of his written report that he analyzed this, that he considered this? You know, that's the leap that I have, is that you may say this was all foundational for him and he certainly reviewed it. But as far as the submission to district court to have him qualify it as an expert, I didn't see anything there.
When you say anything there, can I ask?
Anything there that was contradictory that he had also analyzed or considered or engaged in his theory. I mean, his theory of what happened may be true with other automobiles, but under the lens of facts that disprove what he's trying to assert, I would think he would have to at least say, I considered that, and then disregard it and explain why, in order to qualify as an expert.
And my response is that to the extent that there is evidence that competes or contradicts his opinions, that is something that a jury has to resolve.
So I understand it, you, and I'm not discrediting you, you are arguing that he should have come in because the judge abused his discretion by giving weight or lack of weight to the testimony, a jury function.
In other words, the judge, in his opinion, made it clear he was weighing the evidence and making a decision. And as the Nebraska Supreme Court in a great line says, the role of the trial court is to be a gatekeeper, not to be a goalkeeper. Ultimately, the issue is one for a jury at trial, which is part and parcel of the remedy under the FELA. And in this instance, we're here for a third time, having been dismissed twice before, and now a third time seeking just one thing, to allow a jury to hear the evidence and make a
decision. If I may, counsel, your time is up, but I do want to clarify a couple of things. One, you spent your time talking about the second issue of the case and whether the judge abused its discretion in excluding this testimony. Not the law of a case argument, which you had briefed first. Want to make sure you're still standing by that argument? And if so, I have a question for you.
Yes, I am standing by that argument. Go ahead.
So, counsel, and would like both of you to address this. Is there any Minnesota case law that states that law of the case applies to issues decided by an appellate court by implication? And I know that there's some federal case law out there. I just want to understand if you have found any Minnesota case law, because that's what you're asking, right? Us to decide on the law of the case.
Well, I don't know that we're necessarily asking it to be decided by implication. The clear import of Rule 56 is that only admissible evidence can be considered. And in this case, they argued 702 issues in Mead 1. They spent 4 pages of their brief telling the court that.
But counsel, we never said in Mead 1 that the testimony was admissible. That would have to be an issue that you're saying we decided by implication, correct?
Not really. I mean,
well, maybe perhaps
To do otherwise would require the court to have ignored the requirements of Rule 56.
Counsel, perhaps you can address that in a little more detail on rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, we turn to you.
May it please the court, and good morning. My name is Jeff Markowitz, and I represent BNSF, the respondent. I'd like to start by answering Judge Jessen's question directly as to Minnesota case law and the law of the case and whether a decision can be implicitly decided. I looked pretty hard. All I can recall finding is something that didn't make it into our brief. It was a red flagged case on Westlaw from this court. And I don't think it actually got to the point. I think it maybe had the words implicit decision, but I honestly can't recall. But that was, it was something that, at least in my mind, didn't make sense to bring up in briefing, in part because we're not disputing at least the general notion that perhaps in some circumstances, you could have an implicit decision be the law of the case, but you'd have to look at those circumstances. And here, the court's well aware of what the circumstances were. We had a pending decision in district court on the expert issue, and the district court had not yet exercised its gatekeeping function. And this court didn't yet have a decision to review. The district court didn't, or this court didn't have a discretionary decision to review. The first time that that's happening is now. And if the court doesn't have further questions on the law of the case, I would be happy to spend the balance of my time on the expert issues. With just one final piece, that the Kailwertz decision from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals is highly instructive. We cited in our briefing, and I would direct the court's attention there.
Thank you.
As for the expert issues, experts carry a special privilege and role in the law. Typically, we don't permit people who don't have firsthand knowledge of a situation to opine on what happened, but we invite experts in and we permit them to help the jury. And they don't help the jury if they don't have foundation. They hurt the jury. There's a line from Wild v. Rarig that from the Minnesota Supreme Court on page 41 of our briefing that I think says it well, that there's truly a real and substantial risk that a jury will rely on the expert's opinions only and not actually sift through the facts. And in order to make and to balance the risks and benefits there, we require foundation.
If I may, Mr. Markowitz, isn't really the crux of the matter here the main issue, whether the expert, not that he wasn't qualified, but did he have the factual basis for these decisions, for this, these opinions, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so, and when I look at that, I mean, having reread the Kudrowski decision where it says, look, you know, as long as there's some factual basis, there's gotta be some factual basis, you know, whether that's they considered everything, whether it was correct, even if it was hardly overwhelming, that's for a jury. So to me, I get to the, is there some factual basis? So first of all, is that a fair characterization of Kudrowski?
I think so. I think because Kudrowski, it should be remembered, and we made deliberate efforts to cite its statements of law throughout our briefing. It reaffirmed many longstanding positions in Minnesota case law about what you need for foundation. And Kudrowski itself affirmed the exclusion of some of the experts' opinions there.
So looking at it with that lens, I'd say, okay, is there some evidence the mechanism failed? I would say, well, we've got the plaintiff, Mr. Mead, testified that it failed during the accident. You know, was it due to poor maintenance? And that's where, you know, I'm struggling more to see some factual basis, but appellant's counsel says, well, wait, Mona Brothers had a note, replace driver's seat assembly, and that didn't happen. Is that one, is that your understanding of the record? And two, if it is, why isn't that some factual basis?
I did look back to the notes, and I agree with Judge Reyes's characterization that this was really about the seat cushion. And I frankly don't understand what a seat assembly is. And I don't understand why that note should have led Mr. Muzzy, based on his experience, to say that lack of maintenance is the cause of what happened here. Mr. Mead does a lot of reliance on his own testimony to support Mr. Muzzy's opinion. But I think one of the most important things to remember here is, well, Mead's counsel cited a long list of items that Muzzy cited, listed in his report. There's some 30, 40 of them. What we need to ask is, what did he say he was relying on? And how did he explain how he was bringing experience or testing or qualifications to bear on how we get from the facts of this case and what he said was important to opining that a worn seat cushion and notes about a worn seat cushion or a need to replace a seatbelt, it indicates and should indicate to a reasonably prudent mechanic or railroad that means the recliner mechanism could fail. Importantly here, there are lots of things Muzzy could have said and that he did not. And the point here is not to say that to pick on him for not providing enough foundation. The problem is that there's no foundation. And that's really Kudrowski's concern too. If there's enough foundation, let's not pick and hem and haw at it. Let's say, you know, there's cross-examination, that's okay. But where is the foundation? That's the question that this case asks. And the district court exercised its discretion to say, nowhere. Yes, Your Honor.
For each of those parts. Okay, I see at least some foundation for the mechanism failed. Was it due to poor maintenance? We've got, okay, that it had a lot of repairs. And there's this note apparently that says replace driver's seat assembly and that didn't happen. And, you know, as far as the notice to Bona Brothers, I'm trying to see what, why isn't that enough notice?
So you have two parts that I'd like to address both. As for whether Mead's testimony is sufficient to support Muzzy's opinion, the problem is Muzzy didn't say that. Muzzy at no time says, I've looked at Mead's testimony and Mead's testimony tells me that here's probably what happened here. That Mead's testimony is cited only once in the report and it's to support Muzzy saying Mead was wearing his seatbelt. That's all. And further, if Mead's testimony alone was sufficient, we wouldn't need an expert, which we absolutely do, and which Mead conceded in district court and for good cause. This is a complex chain reaction, mechanical event in which Mead's theory is that the rear end collision triggered some sort of latent defect to rear its head at that moment selectively and then disappear for post-accident testing in a way that torpedoed him backwards. Now we have what Mead testified to as his experience. He experienced this torpedoing and at summary judgment, we take him at his word, but Mead isn't qualified to say and doesn't claim to say what caused that. He says I went backwards, but he doesn't know there was a failure there. He doesn't know he doesn't know what happened there. And this is why we need experts to explain that. And I see, Your Honor, I might have a question or I could go to the maintenance piece. For the maintenance piece, a typical layperson doesn't know and can only speculate why a need to replace a seat cushion or upholstery would lead to needing to replace a recliner mechanism. Muzzy could have told us about if there was a maintenance schedule that would suggest this, or that there was some owner's manual or an industry standard or anything to try to connect the dots. And Muzzy isn't helping the jury connecting those dots. He's just asserting that the dots are connected. And that's the problem. That's the danger here. We need expert testimony to prevent speculation. That's why we allow experts in to help juries, but he's not helping the jury. He's just telling the jury what to do or telling the jury his assertion and hoping and for the jury to follow. And that's prejudicial. It's problematic and Rule 702 doesn't permit it.
Counsel, I have a question for you. And it's been referred to by a number of terms, recliner mechanism or driver's seat latch mechanism or the seat back recliner mechanism. Are those part of the seat assembly? Is that a part of the seat assembly?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. I can only read the report as I find it. And what I find is that the note quoted from Mr. Muzzy refers to replace driver's seat assembly. But then when Muzzy gives his opinion on or assertion as to what he says would have been prudent, he says, given the description of the driver's seat condition and knowing the constant use of the truck's history, it would have been prudent to rebuild the entire seat structure and replace it with a new seat. I don't know why he chose to change those terms. And I would also add this, what is Muzzy adding to this analysis? So we have the note, a jury can see that note. A jury can be presented with that recommendation. We have no dispute from Mr. Mead that he needs this testimony to prove his case. And there's nothing that's helping the jury if Muzzy would just say, look, there was this recommendation to replace seat assembly, even if that meant replace the recliner mechanism. What is Muzzy adding other than just saying Yes, that's true. He's not bringing his expertise to bear. He's just making an assertion without foundation. A jury would be just as capable of making the leap that Mr. Muzzy is making.
Mr. Markowitz, if I may.
Yes.
I just want to clarify, you are not here telling this court that Mr. Muzzy's failure to inspect the mechanism in and of itself renders his testimony unreliable.
No, that's the thrust of the point. That's the classic way you could get foundation, but no, that's not the core problem. The core problem is that he did nothing to get there. I mean, we have two very good examples of how you could get foundation in this case. One was Boner Brothers, which inspected the vehicle, and one which was BNSF's expert who didn't have the vehicle, who went out and got an exemplar vehicle, which was of a similar make and model, and got a surrogate person of a similar build to Mr. Mead in order to actually test the chair. These are very good examples of what you could do to have foundation.
Let's say, Mr. Markowitz, I just want to make sure we're on the same page. You suggested, well, if there's an owner's manual, I mean, even without that sort of inspection, if there was an owner's manual that said this should be done at this mileage, you know, and it wasn't done, that might, you know, and Mr. Muzzy could, that's the sort of thing Mr. Muzzy could rely on, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And to looping back to something Judge Reyes mentioned earlier about the there's a baked in assumption in Muzzy's report that the vehicle was manufactured and designed properly and manufactured and designed the way that Mr. Muzzy says, well, everyone should have known in the industry, this is what you're supposed to do. But as any products liability attorney knows, that's the stuff of products liability claims. Attorneys and litigants are often arguing that manufacturers didn't do what they were supposed to do. Muzzy cites no reason in his report to support his assumption that the seats and the vehicle were manufactured and designed in the way that he says, assuming that's true, the falling would be true. He just assumes it to be true and then makes the leap to assert that this is purely a problem of maintenance and improper maintenance. And I think one other point I'd like to raise as the foreseeability issue and part of the risk of allowing Mr. Muzzy's testimony in is that one of his opinions is that Boner Brothers knew or should have known that the driver's seat recliner was worn and defective. That's telling the jury what to find. And as we cite in our briefing, that is flatly prohibited by Minnesota case law. He is supposed to help the jury, not just go to a mixed question of law and fact and tell the jury what to find on an issue like foreseeability. He just says it is true without actually supporting it with any of his expertise or any of the things we would expect an expert to bring to bear to help the jury. I would direct the court's attention also to Hirchak, which is the Eighth Circuit opinion that we provide in our supplemental authorities. It's a circuit. It's under the federal rule of 702. I recognize that Minnesota rule 702 can have times where it differs, but I read Hirchak and I don't see anything there that impermissibly relies on any higher standard. And it seems rather consistent with the two propositions that we cited it for. One being that when you have an obvious alternative explanation, like it could have been a manufacturing defect or design defect, or potentially, as Boner Brothers said, there was no problem with the recliner, you need to acknowledge that and somehow explain it. Mr. Muzzy did not, and that contributes to the problem of his lack of foundation. And the same goes for gap filling. I mean, this what we're talking about here is really not what Muzzy said in his report. He says many things, but in terms of connecting the dots between a car accident with a drunk driver in which Mead got rear-ended, he doesn't do the only things he does to connect the dots between that event and somehow BNF's being responsible. I see my time is up. May I briefly conclude there? Is simply to point to Lawler's statement. He doesn't cite Mead's testimony for anything other than Mead was wearing a seatbelt. And he doesn't cite even Lawler's deposition testimony, which didn't come until roughly a month after he issued his report. He cites to a contradicted, inadmissible statement, and the district court did not abuse its discretion by excluding these opinions and therefore granting summary judgment.
Thank you. Mr. Kvas, we will turn to you for the last word. But you're going to want to unmute yourself.
Let me just address a few of the things that were brought up. Meade's testimony was more than that he torpedoed back in the seat. Meade's testimony was at the time of impact, the seat recline went all the way back, which is what permitted him to torpedo. And we know from Muzzy's testimony that should not happen at a delta V of 15 when it's designed for 35. The comments about the owner's manual and maintenance schedules is something that really ignores the reality of the use of this vehicle. The person, typical person purchasing a 2008 Ford Ranger does not run it 24/7, does not run it with multiple individuals of different sizes and weights constantly adjusting the settings. And they don't have a vehicle that has to be in the shop once every 14 days in its first year in use. This is not like any other Ford Ranger. To suggest that Muzzy provides no expertise to the case ignores the fact that jurors are not familiar with delta V forces, what those numbers mean, what a rigid seat design is designed to do, and how it protects the occupant. Those are all things that Mr. Muzzy brings to the case that jurors would not have familiarity with.
Mr. Kvas, I'd like to go back to the last question that we had asked before we switched over, and that's with the Meade 1 case. And you argue strenuously that we actually decided the issue of the admissibility based on the expert's opinion. Where did we state that Muzzy's opinion was admissible?
Because that was the basis.
Let me rephrase it. Where did we explicitly state? Because I think you argued that we explicitly decided that issue. Where did we explicitly decide that Muzzy's opinion in Meade 1 was admissible based on the normal analysis that is done for the admission of expert testimony?
The railroad argued in its brief in Meade 1.
I understand what the railroad argued. It doesn't matter what the railroad argued, though. What matters is what we said in the opinion. Well, let me ask you this question. Did the district court decide that issue?
The district court had not decided that issue. The district court had granted summary judgment.
Okay, so if the district court decided that issue, and the district court is the court that decides that issue in the first instance, how could we have decided that issue? That is not an issue for us to decide on appellate review.
If in Meade 1, the court looking at the arguments of the railroad saying that there was a 702 problem with the testimony would have had the ability to remand the case back to the district court if it felt there was any question concerning the admissibility of Mr. Muzzy's opinion, because it had to determine it was admissible, because that's the basis upon which Meade 1 reversed the trial court's decision.
But Mr. Kvas, if I may follow up on Judge Reyes's question, but isn't just what you're saying mean that at best we made an implicit or implied decision, which gets back to my question, whether or not we have case law in Minnesota, which says that can be the basis of application of the law of the case?
I don't have any reported decision I can identify for the court on that issue. My argument is simply based on the construction of the rules and what Rule 56 requires, what was argued, and what options the court had. I mean, if the court looked at it and said, look, we've got multiple pages in this brief in Meade 1 where the railroad is arguing this opinion is not admissible, there would have been an option to send it back to the district court if there was some concern about the admissibility and ask for a ruling. The court in Mead 1 felt it was not necessary to do so and proceeded to decide summary judgment based on admissible evidence, which they had to view Mr. Muzzy's report as being.
Well, thank you both for your helpful arguments and briefing, and thank you for cooperating on doing the arguments on this new technology. The court will take the matter under advisement and an opinion will be issued within 90 days.